I hate the translation blameless in his generation. It's actually a plural. It should be generations.
Goliath is absolutely a part of the line of the Nephilim.
And we know that the Aramaic word means a giant. It doesn't mean to fall. It's actually a noun that means a giant.
Welcome to Kingdoms Unveiled. Our goal in this podcast is to pull back the parts of the Bible that have been cluttered about the supernatural nature of not only the kingdom of light, but the kingdom of darkness. It's hard to fight an enemy if you don't know who they are or where they're at. And that's what we're here to talk about. And with me again today is a dear friend who I've enjoyed doing this with so far, Doug Van Dorn, pastor for over 20 years. And it's good to have you back, brother.
Thanks, man. It's awesome to do these.
Yeah. I'm John Moffitt, the pastor of Grace Reformed Church in Spring Hill, Tennessee. Doug's been in Boulder, Colorado as also a fellow church planter for 22 years. And you give me hope. I'm only 7 years in, so you give me hope, brother.
Time goes quick, man. I'm telling you.
All right. So we're not going to waste as much time this week. I know many of you probably were like, I can't believe those guys cut that podcast right where they did. But we're trying to be sufficient with our time. So last week, we introduced the concept of the Genesis 6 narrative, whether it's supernatural or the Sethite view. And we're making the argument from scripture that we believe that this is a cohabitation between spiritual beings, particularly fallen angels and humans. And so, Doug, we're going to pick up where we left off. And I know we were kind of just getting on a roll there. For us, it's been 30 seconds. For you, it's been 7 days.
It's true.
All right. So any other thoughts? And just for, if you didn't hear last week, my encouragement to you, we're not going to recap that. Go back and listen to it. And that'll save us a lot of time. But any other thoughts?
I can give you one more thing about it that we didn't mention last time.
Well, I was
going
to say, any other thoughts that you had that you'd like to add before we keep going?
Yeah, about men, about the word man. So we said that when man began to multiply, this is the word Adam that's used there. Hebrew actually has two words that we translate with one English word, men, or man. Adam is one. The other word is Ish. And they have overlapping meaning, but they also have distinct meaning. So humans are the only beings that are called Adam, but humans are also called Ish. Angels are also called Ish. And so if you go and read the story in Sodom and Gomorrah, you'll see that two Ish showed up, two men showed up. But later in the text, it says that they're angels. So to me, that actually reinforces how important verse one is. Because it's not giving the generic name Ish for men there, which could be interpreted as
male
daughters of angels or something like that. If you wanted to go really crazy with it,
right?
It's very specifically going. It is going back to earlier in Genesis, but it's not going back to Seth or Cain. The word Cain and Seth are completely absent in Genesis 6. They don't exist there. It's going back to the garden itself and to their father Adam. So that all humanity is being encompassed under the daughters of men.
That's actually really good. I've never heard that argument before, so that's super cool. And you heard it here, right on Kingdom Unveiled. All right, so all Reformed people, Doug, we cherish and love covenant theology, and we love the story from Genesis 3:15, the first promise of the gospel, where God comes and says, I'm going to save you, and there's no requirements put upon you, right? It's all grace, and it is, and we love it, and we preach it, and it's of great comfort. And, you know, I can remember the first time that Genesis 3:15 was explained to me, and it was just this beautiful picture of the gospel. And I love when someone's wrestling with the concept of, you know, are we involved in our salvation? And I would just go back and read in Genesis that the first time Jesus promises to save sinners, what obligation do Adam and Eve have? They have none, right? They have nothing put upon them. Now, in that story, there's a very important phrase that is connected to Genesis 6. And so if we're going to try and explain to you the giants without Genesis 3, we're going to fumble all over the place. So let's talk a little bit about the seed wars, Doug. And this is really hard for people because I can remember the first time wrestling with this. Is that we understand that Genesis is promising us, Jesus is being promised to us as a physical seed, So the seed of Eve, right? The virgin birth is being promised to us right there in Genesis 3:15. And we take that to be a literal physical seed, because if we don't, otherwise we have a really big problem in our gospel. So Jesus is our human savior. What about the second part of the seed? It says the seed of the serpent. How is this connected to Genesis? Or how are both seeds connected to Genesis chapter 6?
No, that's a great question. So yeah, Genesis 3, talking about this seed thing comes in the context, I argue in my covenant theology book, that seed language is actually covenantal language.
Agree.
So when you come to Genesis 6 and then you come to Abraham's story and you come to Moses and Levi and David, all of those have the seed language directly attached to them. So there's something going on there. That's actually the function, by the way, of the genealogies of Cain and Seth, that they're tracing parallel genealogies, but it's the genealogy from Seth that Noah comes from. Mm-hmm. Okay. And why? Because it's going to be through Noah that God will save mankind. That's right. And then through Noah that Abraham will come, and through Abraham, David, and through David, Jesus. So that is actually, like, that's directly tied back to that covenant through the genealogy. The genealogy isn't there to set up Genesis 6:1-4. Genesis 6:1-4 is there to set up what's going on in the rest of the flood.
That's right.
So you have this very interesting verse in Genesis 6:9. These are the generations of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, blameless in his generation. Okay, now this is actually directly related to the seed stuff, because I hate the translation blameless in his generation. It's actually a plural. It should be generations.
Isn't that interesting? But can I make a plug for an episode that we did a couple of weeks ago, that what most people don't understand is that every translation is an interpretation, and it happens a lot. And this is another good example of how it's easy to bring in your theology into the translation, which then influences us, the English reader. Sorry, just a little plug. Go back to the one. It's I think it's Vampires in the Bible is the title of the episode.
I love it. Yeah. So the question is, what would it mean blameless in his generations? And since people don't know what that means, they just go, well, it must just mean that he was the one who was blameless of all the people of the earth.
Right.
I don't think that's what's going on there at all. This, the same language that's used for an unblemished sheep in the law of Leviticus, it couldn't have spot. It had to be perfect. It couldn't have defect. The purpose here is to show that Noah comes from the line that has not been tainted with what happened with the sons of God in Genesis 6. Now, you don't get that necessarily full in your face from just reading Genesis 6. 1-4. But that's the idea. And it picks up again with another related idea that you find in Genesis 1, that God makes all of these animals after their kind, after their kind, after their kind, after their kind. And then that comes back again just a little bit later in Genesis 6, where the animals come two by two according to their kind, according to their kind, according to their kind. Well, if there's nothing going on with according to their kind, well, why even mention that?
That's
Who
right.
cares?
That's right.
Like, that's so over the top redundant, because I think in both places it mentions it 6 or 7 times. And then that's the only two places that phrase is found anywhere else in the entire Bible. So somebody just had they needed to fill up their parchment a little bit more because they weren't going to use it all up. Or, I mean, what's going on? That doesn't make sense. But if you understand the Genesis 6 is, as Jude says, a transgressing of your authority in your proper boundary, and then a union comes about that is not according to the kind that God made, then all of a sudden you go, oh, blameless in his generations, that makes a lot of sense. And according to their kinds, that makes a lot of sense, especially when you start reading other literature out there in the days of Jesus that would talk about, for example, how when there's a Dead Sea Scroll, a really crazy one that talks about how when Noah was born, he was white and shining like a watcher. And so his father has to go and ask his grandfather, like, is this an illicit union with one of the angels? And he's like, no, everything's cool. He's just a guy, but God has his put favor on him. You know, it's basically that kind of a story.
Yeah.
And then you have other stories of these angels corrupting animals as well. And so, you know, there's a reason why it says all flesh had corrupted itself on the earth. And that flesh is not just talking about the sons of Seth and the daughters of Cain. It's talking about animals and everything else. Like, God had to destroy the entire world.
Yeah.
And the Genesis 6, 1 through 4 story there, because it was so well known in the ancient world, everybody knew what it was talking about. And you didn't have to explain any more than that. You could keep on writing and get to the point of what you really cared about as you're writing Genesis, instead of what we have to go back and uncover to discover what was actually going on, because we live 3,000 years after he wrote the thing and don't have a clue what he was talking about.
Yeah, I'll give an example, Doug. If I were to say 9/11, I don't need to say anything else, because everybody that's of this generation knows two planes, towers, terrorism, destruction, death. But all I got to say is 9/11. Mm-hmm. But you fast forward a couple hundred years to maybe a few thousand years, and someone says 9/11, they're like, what is that?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I said the other day to my kids, drink the Kool-Aid. They didn't even know what it meant. Got to explain that to them. And as I think that's to your point, though, is that it's common to them. They're using it as it's common. So we have to then go back and say, well, what? Why is it common? What are they
reading? So where does drink the Kool-Aid come from, John?
Oh, man. Well, Doug, that's a racist statement. I can't believe you're even asking.
Do you know where it comes from?
Yes.
You gotta know where it comes
from. No, it's Jim Jones who tried to get everybody.
Jim Jones.
Drink the Kool-Aid and die.
Jim Jones massacre. All his followers, like 700 people, drank the Kool-Aid and killed them. So.
That's right. No, I said that once to a young adult. I said, you know, I was working for Apple Computer at the time, and I was like, look, we're just looking for people who drink the Kool-Aid here. And she was like, that is so offensive. And I was like, you and I clearly don't think that means the same thing.
Exactly. Somebody's just picturing the big Kool-Aid guy walking down the, you know, the hallway or whatever. Exactly. How dare you? You're like fat shaming or something.
Exactly.
Like that.
So anyways, to that point, I do want to point out too, Doug, you had took beef with generations. To your credit, The New King James, the New American Standard, and the Net Bible, which are all very trustworthy translations, all say generations. They all say plural.
Yeah, yeah.
Just
there's plenty of translations that will say everything that we're arguing for here.
All right. So going back to your argument that we totally got distracted on, the reason why they don't go into the detail of it, you were saying, is because this is a common story, common knowledge.
Exactly. And what God's about ready to do here is start the human race over, because it has become so badly tainted with what these sons of God, these watchers were doing, that he's had to start over with somebody that was pure. Because the promise of the seed was that the seed would come from her and would be a human being, not that he would be some sort of a mixture of some kind.
So when it says, going tying this back to Genesis 3:15, that says the seed of Eve will crush the head of the serpent, or the seed of the serpent is actually what it says.
Yeah, it does say that.
So we are making the argument then that the union between these fallen beings and humans would consider to be the seed of the serpent. Is that
the seed of the serpent? Yeah. We have to be careful here, because there's a doctrine out there, and it actually goes way, way back into Jewish mysticism. Probably Babylonian days of the exile, something called a serpent seed doctrine, where somehow Eve had relations with the serpent and Cain was the product of it. Mm-hmm. So the idea of it is similar to what we're talking about, but we have to read what the text says. And it's very clearly says that Adam lay with his wife and Cain was born. So like, that's off the table.
Right.
Adam, Cain and Abel and Seth were all human beings that came from Adam. But when you get to Genesis 6, this same, I would argue that sons of God, this princely language, have angelic princely language is what they are. This is the same race of being that Satan is. And so in terms of the race, it's the same idea. But in terms of the person, Satan wasn't involved in doing anything in any of the stories in the garden or here in Genesis 6. His problem comes later. But it's the same idea, because you have an angelic group of people that are doing something with women, and they're creating their own seed, their own offspring.
Right.
And these are what are called the Nephilim.
Right. Which we will one day get into this, but not today. There is a amazing, fascinating chapter that you have in your book on 15, chapter 15, about Goliath and the seed and Golgotha and the cross. That's just an advertisement. We're not going to get into that today. All right. So, okay, we've said a lot. So we're going to back up and kind of help you think through this. When you're reading the first three chapters, reading the first six chapters, right? So you have creation, you have the fall, then you have the promise of restoration. And there's a rebellion that's happening, obviously, because there's a curse put upon the earth and there's a curse put upon the serpent. And we'll get into that one day about what that is, what that being is, and how is that all connected. And then you can see that there's a narrative being told to us in Genesis 6 that these angels are, they look down and they see that these women are worthy of taking. And so they take them, and Moses just kind of keeps the narrative flowing. It's like, and from this created a corruption so bad that, and I'm with you on this, Doug, that I don't think it was a local flood. I think it was a global flood, and that he wiped out the corruption. Because I think it would have dominated the earth. These beings, when it says men of renown, and then what you learn about what they become, like reading the story of Joshua and how they're just gigantors of people, and they're eating, they're cannibalistic. I mean, they're just kind of devouring. And so God wipes them out to preserve the line. Now, this is, I know, new for a lot of people, because they're like, whoa, I thought the flood happened because people were wicked. But if you're reading this in the flow of the story, I think it's pretty, in my opinion, I think it's easy to see that, no, this is a protection of the line. I'll make this argument, Doug. God's been protecting his line in different ways all throughout the Old Testament. You can see this. So there are times where he's preserving the purity of the line because we have to have a pure human. And this isn't unusual to start the story in this way. Is that fair?
Yeah, totally agree with that.
Yeah. So So let's work through some of the struggles here in Genesis chapter 6. We're going to take a break from some of the craziness of the seed, because I know this is hard for people. We'll get back to this.
Well, let me give you one more thing. I never had this thought until you were talking about it. How interesting it is that Jews usually will, you know, it's the female that makes such a big difference in terms of the tribal line.
Yeah.
But it's the male that's making all the difference in both the line of Cain and the line of Seth. And so-and-so fathered so-and-so, mm-hmm. and he fathered so-and-so, and there's no women in there. Mm-mm. Well, why? Because it's tracing it back from Adam as the father, the father, the father, the father. Well, guess what's in view in Genesis 6? The sons of God are the fathers. Something has happened to the father line. So if there's ever a 20th anniversary edition, I'm gonna have to add this idea because I think it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, that's actually a great observation. All right, so if there is a union between going back to Doug's illustration, in that you have of their kind, what you have is a new kind of creature. That's what you have. And the way in which it's being described eventually in the New Testament, and we'll make this argument, we'll get you there. But these beings are described as unclean because the way in which they have come together is not of God's design. It's not of natural. It's not natural. I mean, this is the argument that was being made in Jude, even about Sodom and Gomorrah. But yes, there was sodomy, but there was also a desire for angelic beings. I mean, we know that story to be true of Sodom and Gomorrah. So the union of what was happening was an unclean union, was not designed by God. And therefore, the production, whatever came from it, was unclean. Was not of holy, it wasn't of God. And in doing so, we end up learning about these giants. So, Doug, are these just 6-foot people that potentially maybe some of them grow tall and kind of like a shack person? Is this what we're dealing with?
Well, so I have a question, John. Should we go back and address the issue of how an angel could actually do this?
Oh, yeah. Do you think about that? Yes.
A lot of people will... We'll bring up Jesus talking about how we'll be like the angels in heaven, either marrying or giving in marriage. Yep. And
number one argument you hear. Number one.
As people always go back to that. And for that, I would recommend going to James Boyce's commentary on that in the gospel. Is it Matthew or Luke? I can't remember which gospel actually brings that up, but he's a good reformed guy who people respect and trust his opinion. Mm-hmm. He might actually have that in the Genesis one. I can't remember, but go look that up, because the issue here is there's several issues. First of all, they're called men. They're called men. The Bible calls them men over and over and over. People say they don't have sexual anatomy. Well, how in the world do you know that? The Bible actually calls them men. I've never seen one. So,
you just don't know it, according to Paul.
that might be true. I've never seen one that I know of.
Exactly.
To just de facto say that they can't do that is like, where are you getting that from?
Right.
The text seems to say that they could. Second of all, it talks about the angels in heaven. Mm-hmm. But the whole point of these guys is that they're not in heaven. They fell. They committed sin. They did something they weren't supposed to do. So there's that issue. And then a third thing that's possible in my mind, this is one I won't really die on the hill for, but it says they took as their wives. And wives could just be women. And this could be an idea of raping, or it even could be, and this gets really weird into the weeds, but it could be some kind of an idea of genetic manipulation that's going on.
Right.
And people are like, well, that's just ridiculous and nonsensical. But there's a lot of reasons to think that the angels certainly knew about our DNA long time ago. And we're doing this, those kinds of things this today, right now. Yesterday, we were doing them. And to think that angels did not have the ability to do that kind of a thing possibly, is I think that's something that needs to be considered. So there's various ways to think about how this could have actually happened that don't destroy our faith or don't destroy our understanding of what Jesus said about angels in heaven or anything else like that.
Right. Yeah. The function of what happens in heaven is what Jesus was talking about. This is not what goes on in heaven. But
it's what goes on the fallen earth.
That's right. Well, in Sodom and Gomorrah, you got two angels, and those people clearly came to conclusions that there was a capacity for that to happen. So just not trying to be gross here. I know that there are probably parents who are listening with their kids on this, but the idea of this is that I know that that's an argument and we have to look at all of what scripture says. And it is, if it is clear here that first of all, sons of God does mean spiritual beings. If you listen to our God's episode, they are of the Elohim realm, of the spiritual realm, however you want to describe that. And so it does say that they end up having a union. And in this union, I'm not trying to be like rude or cheapish here to people who hold the Sethite view. I don't know how you have it's not one or two people. Listen, in our day and age, over the last couple hundred years, we have pictures and we see people who have the Gigantor syndrome, and they can barely walk, Doug, let alone, you know. I mean, sure, you got a guy like Shaq. But I think Andre the Giant would be the only guy that I know of that was an actual big guy who was scary powerful. Who knows? Maybe he was a Nephilim. We're not going to get into that one. But
oh, we could go there if you want to.
Yeah.
He actually comes from the region where they migrated.
No way. They learn something new every day.
Oh, yeah.
My kids love that movie. It's like their favorite movie. There's rocks ahead. We'll all be dead. Anyways, so when you have the description of these Nephilim, who end up, there's multiple tribes that we can get into, but not today. What you learn is that the men of renown, these powerful men, everyone believes in Goliath, and when you learn that Goliath is absolutely a part of the line of the Nephilim, like his genealogy goes back to the Nephilim, the guy is wearing armor that weighs almost more than you and I, Doug. I mean, 250 pounds worth of, and his spear, you're not seeing Yao Ming got to be wearing 250 pounds of armor and going to go to battle with somebody.
Right.
Yet the guy is tall. So there's definitely something different about these creatures that is not normal, that it is supernatural. And I think that is the point of what the text is bringing out. And what you end up reading about in the Old Testament when they're fighting these beings, they're terrified of them because they are so violent and they are so big. So the production of an un godly woman and a godly man does not create such type of beings anywhere else in scripture, or I would say in science.
Yeah. One of the things that I disagreed with Dr. Heiser on was the height of Goliath. And he took the lower height. So in the Masoretic text, he's about 9.5 feet tall. Mm-hmm. In the Septuagint, he's like 6'9".
Right.
And there was a scholarly exchange that was done in the Journal of Evangelical Theological Society a few years before I wrote the Giant book. There, I think there was three papers. One guy wrote, and then another guy responded, and then the first guy wrote back again. And they were arguing over how big was Goliath actually. And it turns out that that there was two different lengths of a cubit. One was a Jewish cubit, one was an Egyptian cubit. And so it seems like if you use the wrong cubit, you'll end up with a much different height.
Right.
And for whatever reason, Heiser took the view that Goliath was only 6'9". And I started to think to myself, well, now, wait a minute. If you go back and read even what he writes about in the unseen realm with regard to Saul, and this is really an interesting storyline, that Saul was picked, one of the reasons, because he was a head taller than everybody else.
That's right.
And they wanted a king like everybody else. So they picked the tallest, most handsome guy they could find. Well, if David's average size of a Jewish guy in those days, about 5'5", and let's say David was that big, Saul would have been about 6'5", 6'6", pretty big guy.
Yeah.
Now, if Goliath's only 6'9", that's like 3 inches shorter. And yet Saul is absolutely terrified of this guy.
But he's a warrior. And now, he fought.
Yeah. And I write about this in my book. I'm like, look, I had a 6'6" roommate in college, and I'm a, 5'10" or whatever. And he was intimidating to always walk around a guy that's that tall. But I can tell you that if he wanted to challenge me for a fight, I wouldn't be like so scared
right.
that everybody, me and everybody else in the entire school is like, nope, not going to happen.
He's right.
You'd kill us all. I don't understand that. But if we're dealing with somebody who's 9.5 feet tall and who can pick up the tip of his shaft weighs 15 pounds, let alone the shaft itself, it's like a weaver's beam. I mean, That's a pretty frightening stuff right there.
Yeah, you're talking about like the kind of pole that you put a basketball hoop on, man. That's the kind of pole you're talking
exactly.
about.
Exactly.
Well, and I mean, his reputation of being a warrior, and just when you're talking about they come back from the land and they're like, man, we're like grasshoppers in their sight. Well, if you're 5'5" and you got something that's double your size, because if Goliath was, from what I'm understanding, almost 10 feet, I mean, you are going to feel like a grasshopper. I'm like, dude, that guy is literally twice my size. And I've never been around anybody that's twice my size. I got a guy in my church at 6'9", and I'm 6'1". And, you know, he's tall. But being around a guy being 6 foot, around a guy that's 12 feet, I'm like, I would describe myself as a grasshopper. I'm like, dude, this guy's right. nuts. This right. is insane. So there is an essence of where they created a modification, and that modification was not only to corrupt the seed, but to destroy the seed. Because what is Israel doing? Now, I'll mention this now, Doug, because it says that they were here from this union. What did it produce? The Nephilim. And then it said afterwards. And there's a lot, right. there's a lot of theories about, because people say, well, why do we still have giants after the flood? Are they right. still giants? Well, the text says that they are. And then the lineage says that they are, and their actions say that they are. And there's like five theories or four theories out there, and a lot of them I don't know. And some of, I always tell people, is like, I don't know how they got back here, but they got back here. That's what the text said.
Well, this is like the number one question that people always ask, is how could that be?
Yeah.
That they were there before and after. And so there's basically about four answers.
Yeah.
Four logical possibilities. Maybe somebody else can think of another one, but the best ones, this is the logical possibility. So the Jews had a fairy tale that King Og, who Moses fought, lived, who was born before the flood, was one of the original Nephilim, and that he hitched a ride on Noah's Ark, and Noah fed him through a hole in the top or on the side so that it wouldn't sink, right? So I'm not buying that one.
No.
That one's what you tell kids' stories. Second option is that the flood was local. It wasn't a worldwide flood. So, you know, somewhere, somehow the Nephilim survived. I suppose another option with that would logically maybe they were in holes in the ground or something like that, were able to survive it. I don't
know. Right.
Then another option is that somebody on the flood or somebody on the ark carried the genetic material to make it possible later on. And usually that somebody would be, usually people will say it's Ham's wife.
Yeah. That's, Gadawa put that in his book, right?
Yeah, exactly. That makes a great storytelling idea. And then the fourth idea, which is the one that actually fits with Greek mythology, is the one that there was another batch of them that came and did it afterwards. So all the stories of Zeus, who in my opinion is one of the sons of God post-flood, named Satan, that the Zeus stories, I mean, he's the father of like 1,000 children with all different women. It's exactly Genesis 6.
That's interesting. It's
like identical.
Yeah.
But he locked up his father, Kronos, into Taurus, like we talked about in the last episode, and ended up taking control of the divine council with the Olympians.
Do you think
so? That's the one that I actually think makes the most sense, is that there was another group of sons of God that fell. And the reason why I suspect is because they said, well, he promised he wouldn't flood the earth again, so we're good to go.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I guess somehow God suppressed it or prevented it, or maybe used Israel to keep them from dominating again. You know, I haven't really thought about how they haven't become, because during that time of the flood, that's why he flooded it, because it became a domination of problems, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and that's what Israel has to go and wipe out. I think that the main reason why all, and the phrase "and also afterward" is put here, isn't necessarily so that we will speculate
right
on how it happened, but so that we'll connect the Genesis 6 Nephilim to the Numbers 13:33 Nephilim.
Exactly.
Because those are the only two verses that the word actually appears in the Bible.
Right.
And the reason why this matters, it matters actually very, very much, because the word appears in two verses and it appears three times total. Once here in Genesis 6:4 and twice in Numbers 13:33. Well, why does that matter? It's because in Numbers 13:33, it's not spelled the same. One is spelled with an extra yod, an extra y in the Hebrew. And what scholars have suggested is that the reason why this happened is because it was what they call a gloss. Somebody later writing was trying to explain through a little tiny phrase what was going on. So it's like when you read that Moses died, you know, or whatever, at the end of Deuteronomy. Well, he couldn't have possibly wrote that because he was dead, right? So it's a gloss. Somebody wrote it afterwards. Or my favorite one, Moses was the most humble man in all the world. Like, if Moses wrote that, that would pretty much mean that he probably wasn't. So somebody else probably wrote that as a scribal gloss. And so the Numbers 13:33 second spelling is a gloss. And why does that matter? It's because all these people argue that the word Nephilim comes from this word nephal, meaning to fall.
Right.
So that a Nephilim is simply a fallen one. However, there's no way to account for this other spelling in Numbers 13:33 with that root word. It's not possible. However, if the word is an Aramaic word, it is perfectly possible. And we know that the Aramaic word means a giant.
There you go.
It doesn't mean to fall. It's actually a noun that means a giant that you see in the Targum, for example, of Job. I think it's 33, where it's talking about Orion and the Pleiades. It translates that Orion as the giant. It's using that word there in the Aramaic. And so this is why the Septuagint translates Nephilim as giant, gigantus, because it knows what the word actually means. And so that poses huge problems for people with the Sethite view, because how in the world does Christians marrying non-Christians create a whole race of giants?
I mean,
that's happening today. All kinds of people are doing that kind of sin. And not a lot of giants being born. So you have to account for how the Nephilim actually means a giant, and where could that come from? And since we know that that's what the word has to mean, you have to find a way of dealing with that. The second part of verse 4 is really also good. The mighty men who were of old, the men of renown.
Yeah.
So the men of renown are actually, this is what you get when you go to your myths of the nations with guys like Hercules.
Mm-hmm.
Hercules is the son of Zeus and a human woman. And he was a demigod. And he was a man of renown. This is very likely what you're getting with the Nimrod story in Genesis chapter 10, where he starts all of these cities or whatever, and he begins to become a giant, is what the
Septuagint such a weird phrase
actually says. Yeah. So whatever that means, it seems to be connecting him back to these men of renown. Scholars have argued that maybe he's Ninurta or Gilgamesh or something like that, just being called by a different name, mm-hmm. the name Rebel, which is what Nimrod means. And then there's also one more thing with the mighty men, these Giborim in the Hebrew. That's a word that will come up later in the wars with Joshua against the giants. But it's Joshua's men who are called the Giborim, not the giants, not the sons of Anak. And why is that? It's because this is classic God predestining kind of stuff. He chooses the lesser mm-hmm. instead of the greater. And so the actual little men are the ones who defeat the giants, because it's all by God's power. It's not by might or by strength, but by God's spirit.
Hmm. Well, I mean, to that point, you've got David, who is of David's the seed, right? Mm-hmm. Of the seed of the Messiah, who then kills of the seed of the fallen ones,
mm-hmm.
the seed of the serpent. Just throwing that out there. Just
throwing that out there for another episode.
For another episode. Do you think that the whole idea of the, and I've never even thought about this, so I'll just throw it out there to you, but have you thought about what it says and then Nephilim were here again later on or afterwards, that's connected possibly to Deuteronomy 32:17, where it talks about they had new gods, because it says they worshiped new gods they had not come, that had come recently, whom their fathers had never dreaded.
I think that that's a possibility, that the word there for demons is the Shedu, mm-hmm. and those are territorial spirits. So they share something in common with the Watchers, in that they're over the nations, like we talked about in mm-hmm. a previous episode, that these are like the princes of the nations. But it's a unusual word. And to me, there's some sense to be made of, especially when you think about like Moses. It's getting ahead of ourselves if we wanted to tell the whole yeah. giant storyline of the Old Testament, but
we'll get there.
When Moses takes out the Amalekites and he has to hold his hands up, you know, mm-hmm. on the side like a cross, and Joshua mm-hmm. and Hur, whoever it is, have to hold his arms up, or Aaron, I forget who it was.
Aaron, but yeah.
That's a story of them defeating the Amalekites. The Amalekites are a giant tribe.
Mm. And they're supposed to wipe them out, right?
They're supposed to wipe out the Amalekites. So my thought with this is that what happens when those guys die? Mm. Do they become like these spirits that people then begin to worship or something?
Mm-hmm.
And is that possibly related to what's going on there in Deuteronomy 32:17? I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah. It's an interesting verse. I'll read it as kind of a way to close out and talk about what we're going to talk about next. It says, Deuteronomy 32:17, they sacrificed to demons that were no gods, to gods they had never known, to new gods that had come recently, whom your fathers had never dreaded. Fascinating verse. So we'll talk about that later. So Doug, from this, true giants are fun. They're definitely a part of the story. And we're going to start working through helping people look at covenant theology, the flow of the story of redemption, the arc of God redeeming sinners, and how all this plays in. But what I want to kind of add into the story here is the concept of these now giants. Well, they're all getting killed, because we know that Israel's been told to wipe them out. What happens to them when they die? And we're going to make the argument now, and we're going to tell you about it and explain it later. But demons are actually the dead giants. So there's that.
So there's that. Are you just going to drop that bomb?
I'm just going to drop that bomb. You got to come back next week. And next week, we're also going to introduce to you learning how to read extra-biblical material. And extra-biblical material that was very common to New Testament writers, and they would use it. For instance, some of you may have heard of the Book of Enoch. So we're going to talk about how the Book of Enoch, both Jude and Peter, use this and the concept of demons. What are demons? What are they doing? How does this play out? And demons, as I already said, we don't think they're fallen angels, but they are the children of the fallen angels. So, and this does play out, and it does, it brings a lot of light when Jesus shows up on the scene and his interactions with them. So you're going to want to stay tuned for that. We'll pick the story up of the giants, Genesis 6, the gospel narrative, all of it. It's important to our faith. It's important to us seeking first the kingdom of God and understanding, as Paul says, we're not wrestling against each other. We're not wrestling against flesh. We're wrestling against a power that is far more significant than we realize. And this is why we must put on Christ as our armor, by faith alone, in Christ alone. So hopefully your faith has been encouraged, your knowledge of the Bible has increased, and my encouragement too, if you're not in a good church, go find one and join it. We'll talk to you next week.